into central Gaza. 4 out of 5 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The UN warns waste and sewage have accumulated in large amounts in central Gaza, leaving the displaced at risk of the spread of intestinal and skin diseases. I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Good afternoon, this is the Shai Rana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM.
So, when I say Oit Ella, you say Tritina. Okay?
We give it a go?
Sure. Pass and we see a pain of preprint cutest. And same is the same with the blueprint. Recognize the struggle because I've seen it before. Curse of a ton of bloody Sunday and a burning of cork. Barbell that is spark and an emerald iron. Anyone who has a spark and is inside is trying to blacken hands or else to find the leader just to send him to the pattern type the needs for anybody born in the shadow of the main oppression. British war for the years of the greatest pressure occupation over 7 centuries. Connected to history. Please keep the color up and down this aisle. Flag and shoulder, city hall. Think that we recognize under the rubble. And our blood is from a sister from a similar struggle. Oit Ella. Oit Ella. Oit Ella. Vladimir, Reich, and Yorker, Curly Kayla. Oit Ella. Oit. Lanameter, Iagi, Nurka, Curla, Kayla. This is Pentin, trapped by the wall of Israeli, really violated international law. Since the scenes of Patrick, this is Verte, eh? The lean long neglected, the sentence are made, collected punishment. The slaughter of the police, you don't tag anyone through the water of commitment. New ways of democracy, borrowed from death, from the first from the West Bank, and then they died like 1984 on a day to day.
That was a little girl from Ireland singing in Dublin, a song of solidarity. The mantra was about solidarity. It was in Gaelic, and that's why you might not have understood it. She sings about two nations and about the fact that there is solidarity between the Palestinians and the Irish. In fact, she describes them as one people or one nation. And also, she makes reference to the Elbit manufacturing, which manufactures weapons and such. And so, it's a very textured and complex song. And it's actually a song that was originally sung by an Irish rap band. So I wanted to share that with you. This is Zain al-Amin with the Shai of Nana show. And today we have like several multiple short segments that I wanted to share with you. Before we go to the next segment, I wanted to talk about this what happened with the debate a little bit and introduce this little segment because it relates, it's a commentary on what happened with this presidential debate, if you can call it that. And I just find it interesting that people who didn't find the fact that Joe Biden has committed genocide, that he is primarily responsible for the death of over 20,000 children. If you don't care about the women and the men, you should at least care about the children. That should have been the red line for any voter. But no, they didn't really care. A lot of people didn't really care, didn't really criticize Biden for all this massacring and killing. Those are the same people, if you're talking about boomers, who wouldn't criticize Biden for the crime bill and for the Patriot Act. He, one of the biggest reactionaries in the history of the United States. And yet, you know what they're criticizing him about? As you know, they're criticizing him about having a bad debate. And now they're calling for him to step down to save the Democratic Party and to save us from Trump. Now they're asking him to do that. But no, massacring is okay. Crime bill with the and his responsibility for packing the prisons with people of color, it's okay. Yeah. But hey, debating with Trump, bad debate and hesitating and everything. I mean, for God's sake, people knew in 2019, his family knew that he had dementia. Obama knew that he had dementia, and he's the one that spawned this demented, depraved dictator that has insisted, even as people around him, people say he's surrounded by yes men, but that's not what I hear. I hear that a lot of people around him were pushing him, and he kept on repeating something from 1975 that he talked about with Golda Meir. I mean, they're watching this person with dementia repeat something from the past because he can't remember the near the present, and they're just following through. But also, there's another thing that I wanted to say. And I'll introduce this next segment, this short segment. But I want to say if this is what it takes for you to finally criticize them, you really need to check your morals. You really need to. The world is much more dangerous place. And whatever lies he told, they're on par with I know the number of lies that Trump told are just as are more numerous, but the lies that had Biden has told have a greater magnitude in the past year
than anything that I've seen in U.S. history. Outwardly repeating lies from Israeli propaganda about the burning of babies months after they were proven to be false, proven to be told by a group of people, extreme right Zionists, and just repeating them again and again. So that's what we're dealing with right now. And I wanted to share this next piece titled "This Is Not Going to Work," and this is a kind of a whimsical critique of that Adrian Maury Brown had delivered after she listened to the debate, the presidential debate. So let's have a listen to that.
Polly Ed from bed. Hey, my loves. Does anybody know anyone over at the DNC? Like, real question. Because I don't think this is going to work. Like, I know before I came on and said it wasn't going to work. And everybody has been telling me since then, like, you know, trying to subtly say, like, you know, some people are just being too emotional and we can't, like, do an emotional vote this time. Like, we just have to do something else. And I totally hear that. But it doesn't feel emotional. It feels like medical. You know, like, it feels like every TV show I've ever watched prepared me for this moment. Every apocalyptic movie prepared me for this moment so that I can see, like, the kind of person who should be in office when the climate catastrophes all hit the fan and there's a massive global war happening because of decisions that this person is making right now. That's like, you don't even have to be like a scholar. You don't have to be into politics to be able to see that this is not a viable strategy. And you know what I mean. Y'all, please. Like, we have inevitable crisis to face. Do y'all understand? Like, no matter what happens right now, we are heading into a climate catastrophe, super viral, horrific period of human history. Like, that's what's actually coming because of the decisions we've already made as a species. And I know that things fall apart and empires have to fall. And I'm not even against all that. I really am not. But we get to set the stage. We get to determine, like, who under pressure has to make the decisions. And it should be someone who can handle the pressure. And that's not ageist. That's like, if I had any friend in my life who wanted to drive me in a car and acted the way he acted last night, I would be like, hand me the keys, sir. Or ma'am, or, you know, whatever you go by, hand me the keys, I'm gonna drive. But unfortunately, because of how our political system's set up, I can't just take over the keys right now and be like, let me just get us home to safety. We have to count on ourselves to put the pressure on those who can make this decision. Don't give up until we have put that pressure on to the fullest extent. Don't compromise before you've tried. Don't compromise before you have really tried. We have not given them the pressure that they need. That's our job. Let's get to it. Mwah.
That was Adrienne Maury Brown, her short commentary after she witnessed this disaster called the presidential debate between two children. Both have reached a very mature age and reverted to childhood, apparently, or maybe they were always children. I wanted to talk about also what's happening in the development, the developments between Israel and Lebanon. And what I wanted to say is that, you know, as right now, the Israel is like doing what's called psych ops, which is like psyching out Lebanon and thinking they can pressure the people. Now, no question about it, we have Lebanon's full of collaborators. It's full of traitors. It's full of fascists that actually would love to have alliances with barbaric regimes like Israel, and that's been done during the Civil War. But at the same time, Israel is breaking the sound barrier above Beirut and above specifically Dahiya, which is a southern suburb, to basically say, this is what we're going to do to you. We're going to destroy Beirut. We're going to turn Beirut into Gaza. And the reality is that this is not 2006, where the Lebanese resistance beat Israel and in a few days, basically, and made them retreat. And this is not the year 2000 when the Lebanese basically liberated themselves from an Israeli occupation of 22 years, where Israel had occupied a buffer zone. This is a new day. This is a day where, whatever, if Israel was to hit Beirut airport, then Lebanon will be able to hit any airport they want to choose as tit for tat. If they want to hit our power plant, which they've done before, or whatever remains of our power plants, then power plants in Israel will be hit. And that's been shown through the surveillance footage that, in answer to the PsyOps operation by Israel, the Lebanese resistance has shown that their drones can go uncontested and film all these sensitive sites all over the occupied territories, all over Haifa, all over Tel Aviv, and collect a bank of targets that they would keep in their pocket and do a tit for tat if Israel hits a certain target. If it hits a factory will be hit in Israel. If it hits a civilian building, a civilian building will be hit in Israel. That's the reality right now. And that's what the US intelligence, which is, of course, on the side of Israel, but they've been trying to warn Israel not to go into this war. But the problem for them is Netanyahu wants to go to war because, as soon as everybody knows, and most informed people know right now, that the reason the war continued in Gaza for this long, and the reason why now that he's basically wiped out Gaza without winning the war, really, the Palestinian resistance still lives. The Gazans will return home and rebuild. But now he wants to turn, he has no targets. He's killed over 40,000 civilians, and now he wants to turn to Lebanon. Why? Because he's going to keep looking for one war after another. Because, as the well-informed people out there, the well-informed listeners know, that if he stops at any point, he will be taken to court and be put on trial for corruption. And that's what he's trying to avoid, and that's why he's prolonging it. But we're going to listen now to a segment that shows the extent of the readiness in terms of the Lebanese resistance. And this segment is put out by Electronic Intifada, by the brilliant John Elmer, who is a brilliant military analyst in terms of, he's a civilian, he's not in the military, but he knows his stuff, basically. And here he explains the kind of readiness that Lebanon has in case of an invasion. So let's have a listen.
But as I've been doing commonly, we're going to go to Lebanon and take a look at what Hezbollah's been doing. I always try to bring you the first time we see new weapons that Hezbollah brought out. So this first one, number 20 here, Tamara, is going to be the first time we have seen a first-person view, an FPV drone. This is something you see in the Ukraine a lot. We haven't seen it in the Israel battle space yet. This is the first time that we've seen it. And this is coming in here. We're watching. We're on board the attack drone here, and it's going to fly down and hit an anti-drone system called the Drone Dome. It's literally called the Drone Dome. It's made by Rafael, the major Israeli military industrial complex company. So Hezbollah uses their first FPV drone to destroy the system designed to defeat the Hezbollah drone that destroyed their system. These are very expensive systems being defeated here by a very cheap drone. And the fact that the drone is even flying at this point right here is a failure of Israel's multi-billion dollar aerial defense array. But once it gets in close, that's when the Drone Dome is supposed to knock it down using electronic warfare systems, various types of jamming that's supposed to happen that just we don't see happen there. So it penetrates the multi-billion dollar missile defense array that the United States and Israel have been, you know, trying to establish for decades. It misses that. It misses their fighter jets that are flying through the air, constantly hunting for these. And then it penetrates deep enough to hit the Drone Dome, that's an electronic warfare system, and disables it. So this is in Metula. We're going to focus on Metula. Metula's in the Upper Galilee. This will be the first place of occupied Palestine that will come back to the Palestinians when Hezbollah takes the Galilee panhandle, ultimately, at some point. And we're going to show a video here from... there's the Drone Dome. You can see a good shot of it there. And there you can see it landing beside that bird flying by. I watched it a bunch of times to try to figure out if we were looking at a second. It's just a bird. Just a bird, guys. It's not a second drone attack. Okay, so I don't ever do this very... I've done it a couple times. I showed you an Israeli television report when they were first establishing the Netzarim corridor. I've shown you a couple of Al Jazeera reports that when Qassam gives Al Jazeera footage, we show that. But I'm going to show you today a clip that I put together from 60 Minutes, the flagship news magazine program in the United States, hosted by Leslie Stahl. She's, you know, at this point, pretty much the dean of American television journalism. She's the one, she's got a long history. And this is the first time this is a closed military zone. Metula is a closed military zone. The Israeli military is not letting anybody go into the area. No film crews are going in to film it, in a large measure because it's all destroyed and the Israelis don't want people to see that. So it's a closed military zone that no one can access. But back in May, and I've reported on this a couple times, back in May, 60 Minutes did get access to Metula. I'm going to show it to you. Let's watch it right now. It's number 21 tomorrow. Watch how they describe this. There's going to be volume.
Metula has been mostly abandoned by its residents. We saw an eerie scene as we drove through empty streets and no signs of life.
You can see we're going down.
Mm-hmm. We were told that the only residents left spend their days underground in this bunker complex. We met Liat Cohen Raviv, a longtime Metula resident. She showed us a war room where other residents, including the town's mayor, monitor incoming attacks from the hillsides of Lebanon.
The hillside Lebanon?
It's Lebanon.
So Hezbollah?
Yes, this is Hezbollah.
The mayor, not the idea.
Of everything that's happening. Mm-hmm. And we give alerts to the army, and then the army comes.
Are you expecting in your mind that people will return to Metula eventually, or is this the way it's going to be forever?
Do you think?
It depends on how it ends and when it ends. If this will be resolved only through agreement, it is safe to say that we assume that about 30-40% will not come back.
While filming, we were interrupted by an attack.
Okay, so there's another drone.
It was a drone rigged with explosives.
Another drone coming in. Sorry.
They moved us to another room.
Quickly, please.
We later learned that planes tried and failed to shoot down the drone. The explosion killed two soldiers in the Israeli Defense Force reserves.
Yeah. So the Israeli Defense Force reserves are those people that you just saw, the mayor, some civilian that stayed. That's what they're called. The Israeli military calls them reservists, even though they're obviously civilians and they're doing the work. She describes, the woman describes being the eyes and ears of the IDF on the border, because the IDF's not on the border because they're scared to be on the border. They're scared to have positions on the border because they got hit so hard by anti-tank missiles early on in the, going back to October 8th and the early stages of the war. So they've abandoned those positions. They've moved their military back from the border and they leave these civilians as human shields for to be the eyes and ears of this, this military that's telling us that they're about to invade Lebanon. We're watching that in Matula, which would be a frontline place for Hezbollah. If they came across the border, they would take Matula, and there's no military presence in there. They're relying on the mayor in a bunker to tell them that there's a drone coming, and then they deploy the Israeli military. The Israeli Air Force deploys their fighter jets, their American fighter jets, to try to shoot down these drones, and they fail. And then these civilians then get counted as military when they get hit, which is what we're going to see here, number 22 tomorrow. This is a Tufan anti-tank guided missile. So this is the same class of missile. And you can see it's being fired at a building there. So sometimes when you see these Hezbollah videos, like Hezbollah didn't say that they hit. They don't always say what they hit. They'll say it's an Israeli military position. So we're seeing two anti-tank guided missiles hitting this position. And we see these videos all the time, and it looks like, oh, Hezbollah maybe just hit a house, you know. And as Nasrallah always jokes, like, they're not just towers. When you're knocking out their eyes and ears, and all those strikes that Hezbollah hit, all those surveillance towers and all the electronics, knocking down the electromagnetic spectrum for the network connectivity for the Israeli army makes them rely on civilians and the mayor in a bunker to get on their cell phone and phone them and say that they see a missile strike. But that's what we're seeing here, because this was one of the moments that the Israeli military did admit to it. They said two members of Matula's local security team were injured by last night's Hezbollah anti-tank guided missile attack, one seriously wounded while the other is listed in good condition. The pair, like all local security officers in border communities, are listed by the IDF as reservists amid the war. And this, again, just demonstrates that Hezbollah is able to find these positions. They move between these buildings, these houses, and Hezbollah is able to find these military positions as they move throughout this village of Matula that's been wasted in the way that Leslie Stahl told us on CNN, or on 60 Minutes, sorry, CBS. So it's pretty remarkable that Israel allowed that crew to come in. And in the actual 60 Minutes story, I don't think I said it, in the actual 60 Minutes story, Leslie Stahl says that it's humiliating. It's the death of the North, that they've lost the North. Those are the words that she uses, humiliating, which is just the word that's been used to describe Israeli military operations from the late 1990s through to today. Hezbollah humiliating the Israeli military, driving them out of South Lebanon in 2000, defeating them in days in the July 2006 war, which the ground war in 2006 was effectively a large-scale rescue operation, because the IDF's first units that went in, the vaunted IDF units that were going to encircle Bint Jebel, where the, you know, the core of Hezbollah fighters are, they didn't, the Israeli military didn't even get into the village. They got smoked on the outside of the village and then needed to be rescued. They needed to send armored vehicles up to rescue the soldiers that got hammered. And then those armored vehicles got caught in the valleys, in the wadis, coming up the side of the mountain, got their convoys of armored vehicles got hit. And that was what the July 2006 war was. It was essentially the ground war element was only a couple of weeks. And it was effectively a two-week rescue operation to save Israeli soldiers that had got trapped behind the lines, failing in their operation to take over Bint Jebel in 2006. So this army that is more organized in 2006 than it is now. Now they're degraded, their materiel and manpower is degraded by 9 months of war, and they're telling. They're telling us that they're about to invade Lebanon. If you listen to their military planners and politicians, I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure. They are, the Israeli military are doing crazy things. They've clearly lost their minds. But an invasion of South Lebanon with, you know, David Petraeus wrote in Foreign Affairs that the Israelis have 15,000 active duty combat troops. So they would have to call up all their reserves again, pull them out of the economy again. And Hezbollah has 150,000 fighters that have been waiting for this battle. They're connected on overland, connected with a hinterland to Syria, to Iraq, where fighters from Syria and Iraq could join the war. Nasrallah's speech last week, he said that they're telling people to chill out because they don't actually need all the people that want to fight in the south. That was the same in 2006 as well. The Christians wanted to fight in 2006 in the South Lebanese villages. They wanted to fight with Hezbollah too. And so I'm not so sure, but Hezbollah is reacting to the Israeli saber rattling in pretty remarkable ways. So last week we watched a 9.5 minute video that Nasrallah said was shot over many days, all over Haifa, all over their most, Israel's most sensitive strategic sites. So that was last week. And then this week, let's do number 25 tomorrow. This week, Hezbollah released this video called "To Whom It May Concern." In case of an inclusive war is imposed on Lebanon, the resistance will fight, Nasrallah says, without constraints, without rules, without limits. And then they release this satellite map, which just has geo coordinates and moves around. It doesn't tell you what any of these places are. It just moves around to all these installations, offshore gas there. You know, you can clearly see that's a port. You can clearly see that's their strategic oil reserve that we saw in the drone. So this video is called "To Whom It May Concern." It's sent by Hezbollah to Israeli military and security and political figures who all know what these sites are. But Hezbollah doesn't say what the sites are on this video. They just move around to each of the spots in the video. And just, it's called "To Whom It May Concern." Just a real like A plus psychological operation here against whoever thinks a war against us will regret it. You know, Nasrallah said in his speech like a month ago, like, "Habibi, you and whose army, right? Like, who's the army that you're going to invade? Who's the army you're going to battle Hezbollah with? Is it the one that we've been watching for the last 8 months in Gaza? Is it that army?" You know, he said it like, you know, "You and whose army? Who's coming to help you? Because you're going to need more than that." So let me just give you some of the spots here. So it's Haifa and Hedera ports. It's Ben Gurion Airport, pretty obvious. It's the campus, as it's called, the main defense and security compound headquarters, the military command and control headquarters that's in a civilian neighborhood in Tel Aviv. It's the Ashdod port. It's Israel's strategic oil reserves. Those are offshore. What it's showing you there, offshore, those are the offshore gas platforms. They show the Ashkelon power plant. They show the Dimona nuclear plant. They show several military and intelligence bases. And that's the point. The point is that everybody in Israel, everyone in Israel who's making the decision to go to war or planning the war on Lebanon knows what those sites are, and knows that they're in risks, that those sites are at risk. Hezbollah knows exactly where they are. They have precision guided rockets and missiles that can cover the entire territory. Yeah, like I said, the Israeli military is exhausted and degraded from their battle in Gaza. And so Hezbollah has really turned up the pressure, turned up the psyops from the north over the last few weeks to meet this, to meet the Israeli psyops, which are just terrible, just saying, like, we're coming for you. They show a few tanks driving on the back of trucks up the border, and, you know, and then their tweet army says they're coming for you, Nasrallah. It's just all just a joke. And Hezbollah gives us this like real high grade stuff. So that is the battle on the northern border. Again, this week on the resistance report, we went from the very south of the Gaza Strip to the very far north border of occupied Palestine in the Galilee. The first area that will be taken over if there's a war. There's no indication that the war, that the ground, if there's a ground war into Lebanon, I think there's almost as good a chance that the ground war will be inside Israel as it is for Israel to penetrate Bin Tishbe'el and fight in Bin Tishbe'el. I think you're more likely to see fighting in Matula. But again, we won't predict these things. We have enough information, enough facts in this moment to not do predictions and not... to not predict, but those are the facts surrounding the situation on the northern border for Israel. So that is the resistance report for this week.
Thanks for watching this video. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel, hit like, leave a comment. These engagements help us with the YouTube algorithm, and it helps us to get around Silicon Valley censorship as much as possible. It does make a difference. You can also support our journalism by going to electronicintifada.net and clicking on donate now. Thank you.
So that was a report from Electronic Intifada by the brilliant John Elmer. And also, yeah, I do. The Electronic Intifada does a weekly report, an extensive report, sometimes as long as 3 hours on YouTube, that are just absolutely brilliant and the most well-researched, well-written, and well-spoken, that is, in terms of reports on what's happening in Gaza. Now, he mentioned at the end, I just wanted to say one thing before introducing the next little segment here, is that he mentioned Bin Tishbe'el, and I want to tell you something about sort of the steadfastness, if I want to avoid the word resilience, the steadfastness of the southern Lebanese people, is that Bin Tishbe'el in 2006 was almost all flattened. And I went there a few months later after the July 2006 war attack on Lebanon, which Israel lost militarily, but also in the process, of course, created the kind of devastation you've seen in Gaza. There, I was, when I visited, I didn't really recognize the place, even though I'd been through it, and I didn't realize that I was in Bin Tishbe'el until the driver pointed out that we have been driving into Bin Tishbe'el for the last 5 minutes. And I realized that the reason why I didn't recognize it, because the buildings have been flattened where we entered it. There was nothing flat about the resistance of the people. I mean, I was so surprised. The kids were even though there were casualties and things such, the kids were running around, approaching reporters. They also, I talked with them, I interviewed them, and they were like so proud of what the Lebanese, how the Lebanese managed to kick out the Israelis, how the Merkava tanks that went into there were destroyed, and showed me the locations of these tanks, of these dead tanks that were there, that they weren't able, some of them, they weren't able to pull out after they were hit. And also showed me the cluster bombs, which are manufactured here in the United States, which are actually a weapon like white phosphorus that should never be used in civilian population, especially that it targets children more than anybody else because it has pretty colored ribbons attached to them. And they're worse than mines because they have a mercury trigger rather than a pressure trigger, meaning if you tilt them, they'll blow up. And they had left in their retreat, the Israelis left in 2006, 1.5 unexploded bomblets, these cluster bomblets, behind, scattered all over the civilian and agricultural area of Lebanon. And the UN had to come in with knee pads and bomb-resistant uniforms, if there is such a thing, and walk through the, kind of crawled through the fields to clear those out. But they still exist all over. And that's the kind of cowardly act. These are the kind of, it's the most cowardly, immoral military in the 21st century. There's no question that that's what the Israeli military is. People see that, and you can't unring that bell. So they were still defiant, and they were still ready to resist after all that devastation. And that's these kids are going to be there long after Israel is going to be just a stain on history. So with that, I wanted to go to the next little segment, which is a critique, again, from Electronic Intifada by Ali Abu Nima. And it's a critique that really revealed a lot to me, and it relates to Jamal Bowman's kind of late start in terms of supporting the Palestinian question and sort of like flip-flopping on the issue. And I want to say, before introducing this segment, is that I supported Jamal Bowman because he had to face AIPAC. And I mean, I don't live in his area, and I can't vote for him, and I didn't really give monetary, but I told people that I know there to support him because he was under an assault from the Israeli lobby and from Christian evangelists, which are actually a greater danger to the United States than even the Zionists of AIPAC. So the reason, and as you found out now, there was a record amount of money it broke all records in terms of a campaign of that type, in terms of the money that AIPAC gave to his opponent, who is completely detached from the health of the community and completely attached to Israeli interests. And as you know, Jamal Bowman lost. But I want you to listen to this critique, because this critique, Jamal Bowman, there's been, we're having these folks that have started from progressive beginnings and radical beginnings and revolutionary beginnings that have since sold out. And when you look at popular music and when you look at rap, you look at people like Ice-T, who, went from F the police to F the people by playing all a cop in every other show. Disgusting piece of work, Ice-T. What a sellout. I mean, I get nauseated when I see his image in passing, when I'm like looking at an airport terminal or anything like that, where they're showing his, one of the shows where he's playing a cop, you know, somebody who was, you know, was famous, became famous for opposing cops. Same goes for Ice Cube. Total sellout. Total sellout. No, not a thread of radicalism, not a thread of solidarity with oppressed people. Nothing. The only solidarity he has is with his pocket, with the dollar. And lastly, and this is the most disappointing of all, and this is something that I found out about recently, Chuck D, who, you know, who fought The Power, you know, the biggest hit for Public Enemy that he led was Fight the Power, also has gone recently from Fight the Power to Fight the People. And what I mean is, he had met with, believe it or not, I kid you not, you can check it out, he met with Blinken, and he praised Blinken's guitar playing. He made a joke about it and didn't mention anything about Palestine. He was just, just rubbing elbows with this, you know, having fun with this butcher. And it's just the most disappointing thing that in terms of this line of disappointments. And that's the reality that's happening right now. Tupac is probably rolling in his grave. I would like to think that Tupac would have never sold out in this manner. With that, let's introduce the segment where Ali Bonima gives a critique where Jamal Bowman failed in his approach to this campaign because of his flip-flopping on Palestine in the beginning.
Something about Jamal Bowman.
Yes, I think we should. Let's put up that NBC report, Tamara, which is very typical of how this is being covered. Representative Jamal Bowman, a Democrat, member of the so-called Squad, the progressive group of members of Congress from New York, and as the NBC puts it, a vocal Israel critic and Squad member, loses primary. This is a big story because he lost his primary election last night, so he will be leaving Congress. And it's a big story because AIPAC, the Israel lobby group, spent something like $16 million trying to defeat him and clearly was successful, although there are other factors involved. His district was redrawn and he lost some of his base of support. But that's the way it's being spun. But I think there's another aspect to this or lesson from it, which is that there really was a loss of enthusiasm for him among many real progressive people, because he was constantly trying to pander to the Israel lobby while posing as being supportive of Palestine. I'll give you some examples. Recently, for example, Bowman, we can put up that item from Politico, Tamara. Bowman actually at first said that there was no evidence for the mass rapes on October 7th. And then after he came under attack from the pro-genocide Israel lobby, he reversed his position, a very wishy-washy, cowardly thing to do. And he then claimed, quote, that the UN confirmed that Hamas committed rape and sexual violence, a reprehensible fact that I condemn. And then going back to his election, or when he entered Congress, I think was in 2020, and I covered this back in 2021, if we put up the piece I wrote, Tamara, we can see that he was pandering. He opposed BDS. He voted for funding for Iron Dome and other weapons for Israel. In fact, the group within our lifetime, a Palestinian-American group that has been pressing to hold Bowman and others accountable, listed some of the things he's done. So this is reading from their list. He refused to sponsor a resolution recognizing the Nakba. He voted yes on House Resolution 888, equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. Yes on HR 5917, sanctioning the Palestinian resistance. Yes on HR 966, which endorsed debunked Zionist propaganda about sexual violence. Yes on HR 6679, anti-Palestinian immigration bill, and others. He voted for military aid to Israel. So there was just no enthusiasm for him. And I think the lesson here is that, once again, a lesson that people refuse to learn is that pandering and appeasement never work with the Israel lobby. They will not accept anything except complete and total surrender. And then when you've done that, they'll demand more. And this effort to try to triangulate by giving verbal, wishy-washy, verbal, watered-down support to Palestinians while pandering to the Israel lobby and giving them the weapons to murder Palestinians, literally, does nothing for Palestinians. Not Palestinians at all, and ends up not appeasing the Israel lobby either. All it does is drive the debate to the right, give them concessions, and open the door for the people who AIPAC will really support, who will do all their bidding. Mm-hmm. And you can see some of the commentary. For example, there's an excellent piece by Margaret Kimberly in Black Agenda Report, which is a really excellent publication. She's quite scathing, as always, with her headline, Jamal Bowman, AIPAC, Phony Progressives and Black Misleadership. And she says just her conclusion is very sharp. AIPAC doesn't respect the two-faced double talkers. You are either with them or against them. Bowman even made an obligatory trip to Israel in 2021. He shouldn't have bothered. No one respects half-stepping phonies. Black Agenda Report certainly does not, and we uphold the tradition of exposing the scoundrels while working to help create politics which puts people's interests at the forefront. So that is a very sharp, but I think a very fair analysis, yeah. Sadly. And then finally, just a comment from Raja Abdul Haq, who is in New York. He's a Muslim Palestinian activist and community organizer and a co-founder of Quds News, the Palestinian online news network that we often quote in our reporting. And he says in one of his tweets, in the case of Palestine, while Bowman presented himself as anti-AIPAC, he was very pro-Israel. He defended Israel's right to defend itself, supported Iron Dome funding, equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, and accused pro-Palestine protesters of being anti-Semitic. So again, you can see how people are reacting to this. And I think the lessons do need to be taken, but I doubt that they... people will keep trying to tell us, oh, this is a lesser evil. And right. Some people have been saying, in discussions I've been having online, they've been saying, oh, well, it's not that Bowman was great. It's that we should be opposed to AIPAC for taking out, you know, we should be worried that AIPAC has this power to unseat, you know, any member of Congress they don't like. Yeah, that is terrible. But don't ask me, when we're struggling to... do all the things we need to do, to prioritize saving Bowman to make a point about AIPAC over stopping genocide. The only goal should be stopping the genocide, not saving, you know, fake progressives who are really not doing anything for us. So, I know people's views on that differ, but we were told by even some people in our community, oh, Joe Biden is the lesser evil. Joe Biden brought us a Holocaust. Yeah. The Holocaust of our time.
Yeah,
that's what lesser evilism brings. So, you know, people say, well, what should we do? I mean, I don't give advice on voting. It's not what I want to do or where I want to go. But what I want to say is that maybe the answer isn't there. Maybe we can't vote our way out of genocide, especially not by voting for the party that brought us genocide. So maybe different strategies are what we need to be talking about.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what you're saying there, Ali, resonates with the UK. Like, we've got the election in the UK a week tomorrow. Maybe we'll say more about that next week in the discussion next week, which will be the day before the election. But yeah, exactly the same dynamics going on here with fake progressives.
Thanks for watching this video. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel. Hit like, leave a comment. These engagements help us with the YouTube algorithm and it helps us to get around Silicon Valley censorship as much as possible.
Yes, and that was the last segment I wanted to share with you today. We'll see you next week at 2 p.m. on Wednesday with the Shai Onana Show. We'll be reporting more on Gaza.
This July 4th, WPFW presents Let America Be America, from midnight until midnight. Langston Hughes wrote in this epic 1936 poem, "There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this homeland of the free." For millions of people in America, those words still ring true. Throughout the day, you'll hear music, activists, and artists, both contemporary and ancestors, who fought for freedom and who continue to resist. That's Let America Be America on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
From WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. A New York judge delayed Donald Trump's sentencing in his New York hush money conviction until September. This comes after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled Monday that Trump has at least some immunity from criminal prosecution for official actions he took while president. Trump was initially scheduled to be sentenced on July 11th. In a letter to the judge overseeing the case, Trump's lawyers sought permission to file a motion to set aside 34 felony counts related to his cover-up of a sex scandal in the run-up to the 2016 election. The letter also asked for a delay in sentencing while Judge Juan Merchan weighs whether Monday's ruling affects the conviction. Judge Merchan said that he would issue a decision on the motion by September 6. If sentencing is necessary, the judge wrote, it will take place on September 18. In other news, one of the most brutal heat waves in memory has spread over California. It is poised to set hundreds of records, and it may be more than a week before it relents. Inland areas will be hardest hit, particularly the deserts and valleys. Temperatures surpassing 100 to 120 degrees will be a daily occurrence over most of the state. The heat will also fuel an escalating fire threat. Already, the Thompson Fire in Northern California has grown to over 3,000 acres and destroyed structures. The heat wave comes amid the hottest year on record so far for the planet. The last 13 months, including June, have set record highs. According to the science communications firm Climate Central, human-caused climate change has made this week's heat wave in California at least five times as probable. In related news, the Biden administration yesterday proposed the nation's first ever federal rule to protect workers from extreme heat. If finalized, the proposed rule would aim to protect an estimated 35 million U.S. workers from injuries related to heat exposure on the job. That includes delivery and construction workers, landscapers, and workers in warehouses, factories, and kitchens. Among other provisions, the rule would require employers to be trained to spot signs of heat stroke and provide workers with water and rest breaks. Once the heat index exceeds 90 degrees Fahrenheit, additional breaks and increased heat illness symptom monitoring would also be required. The rule is already facing opposition from industry groups, and depending on the outcome of the presidential election in November, the rule could be nullified by a new administration or a Republican-controlled Congress. In international news, the United Nations Coordinator for Humanitarian Affairs in Gaza reported yesterday that 1.9